Hello, everyone, and welcome to Outlook Live, the Federal Reserve System's audio conference series on consumer compliance topics. My name is Jason Liu, and I am the Compliance Risk Coordinator at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. It is my pleasure to be opening today's webinar on Vendor Risk Management, Compliance Considerations. Today, we have three members of our San Francisco office here to present. They include Senior Compliance Manager Ariane Smith, and compliance examiners Catherine Judd and Mark Jennings. Before I hand things over, I want to say just a few words about this event and mention some administrative and logistical details. This Outlook Live session is delivered using a webinar format. You should be receiving both the audio and video via your computer. If you experience any technical difficulties, you may access troubleshooting information through the login screen. With the webinar format, we will be advancing the presentation slides during the event. Copies of the presentation are also available for download using the link on the event player and through our website at www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. In conjunction with the Outlook Live webinars, the Federal Reserve System also publishes a quarterly newsletter titled Consumer Compliance Outlook, which is also available at the Consumer Compliance Outlook website. If you subscribe to the Outlook newsletter electronically, you will automatically be notified of future Outlook Live webinars and also receive notice when a new issue of the Outlook newsletter is released. Both programs are part of the Federal Reserve System's outreach activities and are free of charge. In addition, webcasts and audio feeds, including today's presentation, are archived and are available for playback. So the format for today is for Ariane, Catherine, and Mark to walk through their presentations and conclude the call with a Q&A session. We've received a few questions prior to today's presentation. At any time during the event, you may also use the online chat feature to submit additional questions. We will do our best to cover as many of the questions as possible, but please understand that we may not be able to get to all of them. And if you are unable to stay with us the entire time, you can access the audio feed at a later time. That wraps up my introductory remarks. So with that, Ariane, I'll turn things over to you.
Thanks, Jason. So our topic today is compliance considerations for vendor risk management. Financial institutions are turning increasingly to the use of third-party vendors to provide a variety of products and services to both the bank and its customers. When properly managed, these relationships can enhance competitiveness and diversification of goods and services. However, managed improperly, the use of vendors can be the source of considerable risk to the institution. Today, we're going to talk about how to mitigate the risks associated with the use of third-party vendors. Our presentation is going to be in three sections. First, I'll talk about common uses of third-party vendors that we typically see and some of the risks associated with these relationships. Next, I'll turn it over to Catherine, who will provide you with a number of examples of instances in which the use of vendors presented some challenges to a financial institution. Finally, we'll wrap up with Mark, we'll discuss some common themes that we observe when a vendor relationship is perhaps not working out as planned, and who will provide you with some best practices to make sure you're adequately mitigating the risks that come with these relationships. We'll then end by taking some of your questions. So why do banks use third-party vendors? There are many reasons. Some of the most common are to reduce costs. Using vendors can convert fixed costs into a variable cost structure to accommodate, for example, fluctuations in labor and equipment needs. It can also provide a bank with access to business practices that may be too expensive to build or hire internally. Along the same lines, the use of vendors can enhance the bank's overall performance by providing cost savings through economies of scale and specialization. Vendors can also provide immediate access to expertise that may not be present or practical to develop within the bank. One area where this is commonly observed is with regard to information technology services such as software, tech support, and website development. Finally, vendors may allow the bank to increase the products and services that it's able to offer its customers. So which of your vendors require oversight? The answer is all of them. Ultimately, the board and senior management is responsible for all aspects of its operations, whether those services are provided by vendors or bank employees. A good rule of thumb is to oversee vendors as you would any other division of the bank. So a few areas where we commonly see the use of vendors include the compliance function. In many smaller banks, it's common for compliance functions such as audit, fair lending reviews, monitoring, and in some instances even the compliance officer, to be outsourced. Third parties can also offer products and services. This is frequently seen with regard to mortgage brokers, auto dealers, affinity card, and credit card providers. And don't forget settlement service providers. This is also common in smaller institutions that may not have enough activity to have a well-developed mortgage department. And with the increasing complexity of mortgage laws and regulations, this is an area where you'd want to pay particularly close attention these days. Then there's loan servicing. Many institutions rely on vendors to do flood certifications and provide ongoing monitoring services. And debt collection is also commonly outsourced. In the current environment, we're also seeing many entities rely on vendors to provide loss mitigation, loan modification, and foreclosure services. Now, it's not at all uncommon for financial institutions to rely on vendors to provide software that allows them to produce accurate disclosures for both credit and deposit products to its customers. In some instances, we're even seeing where information is provided to the vendor to produce individual disclosures rather than purchasing software that a bank staff may use to provide the documentation. And then last but not least, technology providers. As previously mentioned, we often see this with regard to things like tech support and website development. And this makes sense given the highly specialized skill set required and the pace of change with regard to technology. Now, this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are undoubtedly many other instances in which a bank may use a third-party vendor. So what are the risks associated with vendors? First, there's reputation risk. Don't forget that your customer may not know or care whether a vendor is providing a service to them. To that customer, it's all a part of the bank, and if they're not getting the service they expect, it can damage the bank's image in their eyes, and they may not be shy about sharing their dissatisfaction with their friends and family, or even with the world via the internet. More broadly, violations that originate with vendors can result in public enforcement actions or sanctions against the bank that may lead to a negative perception of the bank and the communities that it serves. Then there are operational and transaction risks. Examples here include failed processes and systems and issues with product delivery. For example, if your vendor doesn't have adequate contingency planning, unanticipated events can result in business disruption or subpar service to the bank and its customers. Similarly, inadequate information security controls could result in the loss of confidential bank or customer information. Then there's credit risk, and this can result on two fronts. It's possible that the vendor may not be able to meet the terms of its contract with the bank if its finances are not properly managed. Or if the vendor is providing any type of credit risk management services for the bank and is not doing what it should, this could result in the customers that receive credit from the bank not being adequately qualified to meet the terms of their obligations. Last but not least, of course, is compliance risk. As previously mentioned, the bank is responsible for the activities of its vendor. This means that violations resulting from the vendor's actions will be cited against the bank and could result in significant adverse impact on the bank's compliance rating. And this includes things like ratings downgrades, enforcement actions, civil money penalties, and even legal actions such as referrals to the Department of Justice. Examples of areas where we typically see violations include deceptive marketing, discriminatory lending, and privacy. Now, one specific compliance risk that you should particularly be aware of is the risk of unfair and deceptive acts or practices, or UDEP. UDEP risks are heightened with the use of third-party vendors because the vendor is often positioned between the bank and the customer, is deeply involved in the delivery of products and services, and has unfettered access to the bank's customers. And unfortunately, the vendor may not be adequately monitored by the bank. Now, UDEP violations can occur when a vendor is not aware of the necessary disclosure requirements. For example, if a vendor does not adequately disclose fees or finance charges associated with a product, it could result in a finding of unfair practices. Now, this is often inadvertent on the vendor's part, but unfortunately, some practices may be intentional and could result in a finding of deception. This could occur, for example, if an unscrupulous telemarketer knowingly makes misrepresentations or omits vital information that a customer needs to make an informed decision. Unfortunately, UDEP concerns are not always easy to spot, they're not always apparent, and may be involved in commonly accepted bank practices. So this is an area to pay close attention to. Catherine's going to give you some examples of instances where vendor activities have resulted in either concerns or, in some instances, in violations of UDEP for banks. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Catherine.
Thank you. Now we'll go over some examples of third-party vendor relationships in which bank management did not properly monitor a third-party vendor. The first case involves a vendor for flood insurance monitoring. Now, there's nothing wrong with using a vendor for this purpose. However, providing correct information to the vendor and monitoring vendor activities are key. In this case, bank management used a vendor for monitoring flood insurance requirements, including requirements that all properties in the flood zone had flood insurance, that all insurance amounts were correct for the specific property covered, and that the appropriate insurance coverage remained in effect during the life of the loan. The issues first arose here because the vendor wasn't given the correct information by the bank regarding the insurance amounts required for each property. This affected multiple properties and resulted in multiple instances of insufficient coverage. Unfortunately, the situation was worsened because bank management relied on the vendor completely. Management did not monitor vendor activity, review vendor activity, or conduct any analysis to verify the vendor records were in line with correct flood insurance amounts. As a result, bank management did not self-identify these problems. There were significant flood violations involving multiple properties, and civil money penalties were imposed. The next area is loan modifications. In this case, a vendor was used to process loan modification requests under the Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP. Because this was a new program at the time, the bank thought it would be best to rely on experts in this area to process the modification requests. Because the vendor was considered an expert, the bank did not think it was necessary to review or monitor their work, and they relied on the vendor completely. Issues arose when the vendor didn't process the requests as expected. There were delays of several months in processing borrower requests, repeat requests for documentation from borrowers, and other delays, which resulted in hardships for borrowers. Bank management was not monitoring the vendor's activity and was not aware of the significant processing delays and other problems with the vendor. This resulted in significant exam findings, including UDAP issues of unfair or deceptive practices being raised. Bank management ended up doing a complete file search, taking extensive corrective action involving resolicitation of some borrowers whose requests had been incorrectly handled by the vendor, and significant changes to the bank's compliance program as a result. The vendor may be an expert, but the bank is still responsible for monitoring and verifying vendor activity. The types of concerns identified here with mortgage loan modification vendors are similar to concerns identified in mortgage servicing reviews of the foreclosure process at 14 mortgage servicers, which was conducted jointly by the regulatory agencies. This interagency review, among other things, identified issues resulting from inadequate monitoring and controls to oversee foreclosure activities conducted on behalf of the servicers by external law firms or other third-party vendors. The agencies are taking formal enforcement action against each of these 14 servicers and their parent bank holding companies because of the deficiencies and weaknesses of the third-party vendors. So mortgage origination, modification, and servicing are areas where vendors are commonly used and could create risks for the bank. Next area is credit card relationships. In this case, a vendor was used to administer and market credit cards. The vendor was marketing a balance transfer credit card program as a way to get a new credit card while paying down the balance on an existing credit card. However, the vendor didn't properly disclose all the fees connected with this product. Bank management wasn't monitoring or reviewing the vendor's activities, so they did not identify these errors. This action by the vendor raised UDAP issues based on deceptive marketing. The vendor failed to disclose the fees, and the bank is responsible for vendor's actions or inactions. In this case, the customers did not have all the information they needed about the product to make an informed decision. Bank management was not monitoring or reviewing the vendor's activity and didn't identify that there were problems with the disclosures. However, whether the disclosures are provided directly by the bank or by the vendor, the bank is responsible for compliance with all applicable regulations. This resulted in violations of UDAP for deceptive practices, enforcement actions are being issued, and a large settlement being made by the bank. The next area is disclosure generation software. In this case, third-party vendor software was used to generate disclosures for customers for various products. After changes in the regulations, the vendor failed to make the required changes to the software, resulting in errors on the disclosure forms. Issues arose because bank management relied on the vendor and didn't do their own review of disclosures. Management didn't adequately monitor or track the required changes, didn't verify that the required changes were made by the vendor, and did not review their own disclosure forms to ensure the changes were implemented correctly and disclosures were in compliance. In this case, the violations were limited. However, the examiner's assessment of the effectiveness of the compliance management program was impacted by the failure of program management to adequately manage and maintain oversight over their third-party vendor. The next area is third-party payment processors. Now, this is not a normal third-party vendor relationship. It involves a relationship with bank customers and their merchant clients. Third-party payment processors, also known as TPPPs, are bank customers who use their accounts to process payments for merchant clients. TPPPs typically process payments by creating and depositing remotely created checks or by originating ACH debits on behalf of their merchant customers. Traditionally, they have served retailers with physical locations. However, with the growth of internet-based commerce, they're increasingly providing services to online businesses and telemarketers, firms that can pose substantially greater risks based on possible involvement in illegal practices. In this case, the illegal practices of the merchant clients included luring customers into trial memberships for bogus money-making schemes. They then repeatedly charged them monthly fees for these and other memberships for which they never signed up. The suspect firms relied on TPPs to keep their schemes going. The bank had no effective means of verifying merchant client identities or business practices. Business practices that involve these illegal activities create BSA, AML risk, and possible UDAP risks, as such practices are often unfair and deceptive. In this case, the bank was cited for failure to comply with BSA based on lax treatment of accounts belonging to these third-party payment processor customers. This resulted in a consent order being issued requiring that all bank personnel whose work involves TPPP activities have sufficient training on BSA AML risks and specialized training on the risks of TPPP activity, fraud red flags, and appropriate customer due diligence, maintenance, and documentation. The bank also had to develop a formalized process for reviewing TPPP transactions to ensure that no related suspicious activity went unreported. This type of activity could also result in UDAP findings if it's determined that the merchants engaged in unfair or deceptive practices. And the next area is revenue enhancement. Some vendors are now offering revenue enhancement services for a variety of bank products and services. For example, there are vendors who are offering overdraft protection software marketed to increase bank revenue. With lending volume being low and banks looking to other areas for revenue, this service by some vendors may seem attractive. However, bank management remains responsible for activities of the vendor and should ensure vendor practices do not subject the bank to compliance problems. We recommend that bankers conduct due diligence with every vendor prior to entering into a third-party relationship, conduct a risk assessment of the proposed vendor activities, and fully understand the vendor activities to ensure not only technical compliance with all applicable laws and regulations, but also understand the impact to the consumer. Are there any UDAP issues? Are there any unfair or deceptive acts or practices involved? Bank management is responsible for ensuring the customer is being advised of all information needed to make an informed decision about the product or service being offered by the bank. These are just a few examples of compliance issues arising due to third-party vendor relationships. These examples raise some common themes that Mark will now cover.
Thank you, Catherine. I will now be covering common themes we see in problem areas and best practices from successful vendor risk management programs. Over-reliance on third parties, and sometimes complete reliance, is the most common root cause of vendor-related compliance problems. Third parties can provide staffing and expertise, but cannot eliminate responsibility for compliance violations involving products or services offered by your institution. You need to ensure that products or services offered by your institution are in compliance. Failure to fully understand vendor activities or retain knowledgeable staff can also be a major issue. Even though you may be leveraging a third party's expertise, staff at your institution must be knowledgeable about vendor activities and the applicable compliance requirements for that activity. Proper staffing or specialized training for existing personnel may be in order. Likewise, you should consider evaluating vendor activity at their location to ensure risks are understood and that you have sufficient knowledge of vendor processes and controls. Failure to adequately monitor the vendor is another major problem. Ongoing monitoring is needed to ensure compliance. Best practice suggests having a written, risk-based, ongoing monitoring policy. Monitoring should include information from the vendor and any available outside information, including complaints, financial statements, news articles, and feedback from other institutions. More common themes include the old issue of garbage in equaling garbage out. You must ensure that the information you provide your vendor is complete and accurate. This includes contractually established expectations. If you do not clearly communicate all of your expectations in the contract, you are setting the vendor up to fail. Consumer protection requirements should be detailed and put your vendor on notice that you are aware of the applicable requirements and be validating compliance with those requirements. Examiners will expect to see consumer compliance specifically addressed in contracts. Lastly, as covered earlier, violations of law pose many risks to your bank. You do not want to discover problems by having examiners cite violations. You need to be proactive in identifying issues and correcting them. The steps you take to verify and ensure compliance will minimize the adverse impact on both consumers and your institution. Best practices. Before selecting a vendor, you must conduct proper due diligence. This includes getting references, particularly those from other financial institutions, ensuring the financial stability of the company by reviewing audited financial statements, asking questions about the vendor's data backup system, continuity and contingency plans, and management information systems, researching the background, qualifications, and reputations of the vendor's principals, and lastly, assessing the vendor's overall reputation, including lawsuits filed against it. A detailed risk assessment should be built off the initial due diligence review. It should be provided to senior management and the board prior to engaging in a new risky activity. The risk assessment should identify all of the different categories of potential risk faced by a vendor's activity, including compliance, reputational, operational, credit, and transaction. It should also identify all of the applicable laws and regulations and how they are addressed. Contracts should address compliance with consumer protection laws and regulations. Contract provisions should be based on identified risks and contain the right to request information that demonstrates compliance, such as audit and monitoring reports. Some of the issues to be addressed in the contract include, but are not limited to, scope of the outsourced services, terms of the agreement, written procedures, minimum service levels, approval required for vendor use of subcontractors, right to conduct audits or request third-party reviews, confidentiality of data, warranties, liabilities, and disclaimers, dispute resolution mechanisms, default and termination provisions, and consumer complaints, and who is responsible for responding to them. More best practices include having a comprehensive risk-based monitoring that is based on the risk assessment developed during the due diligence. The frequency and type of monitoring to be conducted should be documented for each vendor. The results of monitoring should feed into the risk assessment process and result in updating the vendor's risk profile. Vendor oversight staff must be trained and familiar with the vendor to ensure they fully understand the risks and can conduct thorough monitoring. Consumer complaints need to be tracked and are an excellent indicator of problems with the vendor. So too is feedback from other institutions who also use the vendor. Keeping the board properly informed and trained on vendor issues is key to ensuring they can provide proper oversight and limit the institution's total risk to an acceptable level. The board should receive the initial due diligence, risk assessments, the vendor management policy for review and approval, and the results of monitoring. So in conclusion, while processes may be outsourced, full compliance accountability cannot be. Some degree of risk will remain with the institution who offers the products or services or whose name is associated with those products or services. A vendor's value is in the expertise and experience they offer. However, active risk management oversight is still required regardless of the vendor's reputation or apparent ability to operate in compliance with laws and regulations. A complete vendor management program contains four main elements: adequate due diligence, a thorough risk assessment, a properly structured contract, and ongoing risk-based oversight. There are Federal Reserve resources available that provide more information on this topic. These resources focus on overall vendor risk management, specific issues related to vendor use and UDAP, and best practices for mitigating risk when outsourcing. You are highly encouraged to review these documents. In addition, here is a sampling of resources produced by other agencies. As you can see, expectations discussed today for vendor risk management are part of every agency's agenda. You would be well served to review all of the available resources while you are building or enhancing your vendor risk management program. In addition, make sure to reach out to your regulator to ensure that you understand their expectations concerning your vendor risk management. Now, I'll turn it over to Jason so we can address questions that you may have.
Thanks, Mark. So let's go ahead and dive right into the Q&A session. We've received quite a number of questions on technology-related issues that range from cloud computing to the various information security reports that relate to service providers. Ariane, do you want to tackle these?
Yeah, Jason. So, you know, IT and information security questions really fall outside of the scope of our expertise, but I think that it actually demonstrates a good principle, which is that, you know, depending on the service provider and the service they provide to you and what they do for you, you may need some specialized expertise and advice to understand whether or not you're doing proper due diligence and asking the right questions of that service provider. So, unfortunately, while I can't personally give you specific advice about IT questions, I can actually turn you to some resources that are available on the Internet. And the first is an SR letter, which is a Federal Reserve Supervision and Regulation letter. It's SR00-17, which is basically from the year 2000, and it's called Guidance on Risk Management of Outsourced Technology Services. That letter is available on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors website, which is www.federalreserve.gov. Now, I'm actually going to give you a couple of links here, and so if you don't get these, just note that we will make these links available also in an issue of the Consumer Compliance Outlook magazine. So hopefully that will give you some resources to turn to. But again, SR letter 00-17, Guidance on Risk Management of Outsourced Technology Services. Now, the FFIEC, which is the Federal Financial Institutions Examination Council, also has issued a guidance on outsourced technology services. There's an IT booklet on outsourcing technology services, and that is available on the FFIEC website, which is www.ffiec.gov. And then some other sources that may be beneficial to you include Cloud Security Alliance, which is a good website for research, and that is Cloud Security Alliance, all one word, .org. Then there is the ISACA website, which is the Information Systems Audit and Control Association. They also have information on cloud computing, security, and governance and assurance. So that website is www.isaca.org. Once again, www.isaca.org. And then there's also the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is part of the U.S. Department of Commerce, and they have a special publication, 800-146, Draft Cloud Computing Synopsis and Recommendations, and that is available at CSRC, C as in cat, S as in Sam, R as in rainbow, C as in cat, dot NIST, so National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST.gov. I'll say that one more time, CSRC.NIST.gov. So that's a good start to get you some information. I'd also recommend that you contact your prudential regulator. Every agency, including Federal Reserve, we have IT specialists that would be able to talk to you regarding specific concerns you have about IT security and risk management issues. So that's another resource that you can use.
Great. Thanks, Ariane. So moving on to the next question, what level of monitoring or review of a vendor is sufficient? Should the bank conduct an on-site audit of the vendor's processes, and should they require the vendor to submit their internal audit compliance reviews to the report? And there's also some follow-up with that question with regards to, you know, is a vendor questionnaire sufficient regarding their internal procedures? So, Catherine, I'll go ahead and throw that question to you.
Okay. Banks will want to have a standard baseline level of monitoring for each vendor. However, it may want to review or monitor some vendors more often than others at a deeper level or more frequently. The appropriate level of monitoring and review of the vendor depends on your risk assessment of that vendor, so you want to go back to your risk assessment. Some of the factors which indicate additional monitoring might be needed include customer complaints received about the services from this vendor, unsatisfactory past audit or compliance review results, or a vendor's unwillingness to share their internal audit results. Again, your level of monitoring should match the risk associated with each vendor from your risk assessment and should be appropriate to that vendor activity. All monitoring activities that you expect should be included in your contract. So if you're expecting to have on-site audits or requiring the vendor to submit their internal audit compliance review reports, that should be in your contract with the vendor. So again, there should always be a standard baseline level and frequency of monitoring the bank will do for each vendor. And remember, no vendor should be considered too good to be subject to monitoring and review by the bank.
Great. Thanks, Catherine. Ariane, I'll throw a question to you. This relates to contracts. Specifically, the question is, to what degree is the reasonable, is it reasonable to rely on contract terms promising compliance with all federal and state laws and regulations?
That's a great question. You know, as examiners, we have a phrase that we use in our work, which is trust but verify. So, you know, it's absolutely important that your contract contain those terms and that your vendor is making representations to you that they will comply with laws. But ultimately, if they don't, it's the bank that's on the line for that with regard to those services they're providing to you. So I think that having that statement in the contract is good, but you do want to follow up with some additional verification and monitoring on your part to make sure that they are actually complying with the terms of that contract so that you don't end up with the violations. I think another thing that's important to remember is that even with that that clause in the contract, what that generally gives to the bank is that it allows some recourse to the vendor, usually financial or otherwise, that if there are violations, the vendor's going to fix it or, you know, compensate the bank for costs associated with that. But again, it wouldn't prevent an examiner from citing a violation. It wouldn't prevent any enforcement actions or that type of thing against the bank. So, you know, the level of due diligence and monitoring that you do will be dependent on kind of the critical nature of the services and the risk associated with it, as Mark talked about. But definitely, you want to do something and not just rely on that statement in the contract.
Great. Thanks, Ariane. Follow-up question to that. We have understood that privacy, flood, BSA, and red flags must specifically be addressed with relevant vendors. Is this accurate, and are there others?
I have not specifically seen that guidance. I don't know whether it's out there or not. It may be, but I think that those are things that I would definitely specifically want to address with my vendors because those are high risk regulations, and there are significant ramifications that go along with violations of those. So I would specifically discuss those with vendors that are providing those types of services. But that's not the only thing that I would make sure I specifically talk about. Things like UDAP, which is Unfair and Deceptive Acts and Practices, Fair Lending, ECOA, those types of things. If you have mortgage brokers, you're working with mortgage brokers or indirect auto dealers or telemarketers, again, those are really high-risk regulations. The ramifications of violations are very significant, so I would want to make sure that if I'm working with vendors that are providing those kinds of services to me, that I'm specifically addressing those regulations and compliance with those. So, you know, those are some examples, but again, I think it goes back to the risk assessment and the service that vendor is providing to you. When you're doing that assessment, when you think about what is that vendor doing to me, what are the consequences of any kind of breakdown in that service, what are the consequences to me as a bank, could I end up with millions of dollars worth of civil money penalties, could I end up in litigation, you know, those are the kinds of questions you want to think about, and the more serious those ramifications, I think the more I would want to make sure that I'm specifically addressing those, whether it's regulations or otherwise, with the vendor in that contract and in our discussions.
Great. Thanks, Ariane. Mark, we got a compliance program question. Specifically, what are we supposed to do if a vendor pushes back against requests for audits?
Great. Thank you, Jason. It's important to establish up front with the vendor your right to request information that validates that the vendor is in compliance with all applicable requirements. If the vendor refuses to provide such information, you can let them know that it is required by your regulator. Vendors who do not have the ability to demonstrate that they are in compliance with laws and regulations, or maybe who protest too much, should not be used, as this may indicate they have serious issues they'd rather not share with you.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Another question that we received, and I'll give this one to you, Mark, as well. We have a question on affinity card relationships. What is the bank's responsibilities for these types of relationships when we are not the creditor? whether you're dealing with an affinity card relationship, brokers, auto dealers, or any of the like, or any other party that is making a credit decision, an important first step is to verify that you, in fact, are also not a creditor. You should document your analysis and make sure that your regulator agrees with your conclusion. Regardless of the creditor issue, the bank will still be exposed to reputational and potential legal risks from activities it is associated with, and therefore needs to limit the exposure to these risks through monitoring for compliance with applicable laws and regulations.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Ariane, here's the appraisal question for you. What requirements are there for reviewing the operations of an appraisal management company? If we use a third party to manage the process for ordering and reviewing appraisals to keep the process independent along with 100 other banks, what are our responsibilities for reviewing their operations?
So, you know, I think the requirements don't can be thought of more broadly than appraisal management companies. A lot of vendors are providing services to many banks, not just your own. And so I think you could ask that question of just about any vendor. And I think what it gets down to is that whether this vendor is servicing 100 customers or 1,000 customers, each bank still has individual risk. So I don't know that I would do less just because a vendor is servicing more customers than another. Now, that may give you really great information about the quality of their services, what they provide. I would expect a vendor that's servicing a lot of customers to have a more sophisticated operation and to probably have some better controls in place. That's all the same kind of information that that you would should be getting from them when you do your due diligence. But at the end of the day, whether you the type of due diligence that you do in an ongoing manner, you should still be doing your own monitoring and things no matter what other banks that vendor is servicing, because you'll still have the violations. There won't be an instance where we say, well, this vendor serves 1,000 people, so there's not a problem here. Ultimately, you're going to pay the price. So I think you have to assess that risk and then do your due diligence again based on that risk that vendor poses to you.
Thanks, Ariane. So, Mark, we've gotten a number of questions on the best practices that you listed earlier, as well as the minimum contract requirements that you covered in your presentation. I don't know if you have the resources available, but if you could double back to those questions.
Absolutely, and thank you for those questions on this issue, because it is very important to get the relationship set up front to help ensure, you know, compliance on an ongoing basis. So I'll just repeat the list that I gave initially and then refer you to the resource where you can find additional items that could be included in a contract. But just to repeat the items that I had initially listed, you want to include the scope of the outsourced services. So in other words, you want to set out clearly the full range of the activities that you expect the vendor to do for you. So that's scope of outsourced services, terms of the agreement. So in other words, how long it's going to be in effect, the payments, expectations, and so forth. So terms of the agreement, written procedures. So in other words, that is the expectation that the vendor have written procedures that detail what they're going to be doing for you and also how they are in compliance. So that's written procedures, minimum service levels. So this is setting out the expectations that you have for the vendor to provide their services to the customers. So minimum service levels, approval required for vendors' use of subcontractors. Now, this is very important so that you can fully track and understand the risks, because they may use a subcontractor that you would otherwise have a problem with. So again, that's approval required for vendors' use of subcontractors. Next item is right to conduct audits or request third-party reviews. That is so you can obviously verify that the vendor's activities are in compliance with different laws and regulations. So the right to conduct audits or request audits that have already been done. Next is the confidentiality of data. Obviously, that is important in regard to privacy laws and regulations and information security laws and regulations. So confidentiality of data, warranties, liability, and disclaimers. Now, you'll want to include this provision just to put the vendor on notice of the expectations and the issues that can arise and what their responsibilities can be and the impact on them can be. So, again, that's warranties, liabilities, and disclaimers. Next is dispute resolution mechanisms. So if you and the vendor have a dispute regarding a contractual item or maybe something that wasn't covered in the contract initially, you want to have a provision that covers how those disagreements will be handled. So just to repeat, that's dispute resolution mechanisms. The next item, default and termination provisions. So this is how you'll be able to get out of the contract if there is a serious issue. So default and termination provisions. And lastly, customer complaints. Mm-hmm. Who's responsible for responding to them, the adequacy and expectations regarding the timeliness and the completeness of those responses. So again, customer complaints and who's responsible for responding to them. Now, more information on vendor contracts can be found under the Federal Reserve Resource Vendor Risk Management Outlook Newsletter article, 2011, and the hyperlink is listed underneath the Federal Reserve resources. This is the first bullet point on that page at the end of the presentation.
Great. Thanks, Mark. So actually, before I get into some additional questions, we did get one on NCUA guidance, so I'll throw that out there. I just did a quick search, and there is a letter. It's letter number 01-CU-20. So kind of jumping back to Mark's comment about resources specific to the other regulatory agencies, this is just a sampling of the guidance that's out there. Would encourage you to talk to your primary regulator to find out what other guidance they provided to their institutions. So, again, it's just more a sample that, you know, all of the agencies are considering service provider risk. So jumping back into questions, Ariane, I have a question for you. Specifically, what is an appropriate rule of thumb for determining the amount of oversight needed for a vendor relationship as a measure of hours percentage of an FTE?
I hate to sound like a regulator, but I'm going to do it and say there's no one right answer for that. I can't tell you that, you know, 4 hours is appropriate for this vendor versus 10 hours for another vendor. Again, I think that really has to go back to your risk assessment. And, you know, when you're doing a risk assessment, I think one of the things you need to do is sort of, you know, triage your vendors, for lack of a better word. Some vendors provide very critical services to you that expose you to a lot of risk. Again, if you have telemarketers and they are maybe engaged in unfair or deceptive acts and practices, maybe they're, you know, again, not misrepresenting information or omitting information, that's a very different risk than a vendor that's not providing that that kind of service to you. So I think the amount of time is going to be dependent on what your risk assessment tells you. So you might want to, when you're doing a risk assessment, segment your vendors. So these are my high-risk vendors, these are my moderate risk, these are my low-risk. And then based on that, then you want to decide, this is the amount of time that I need to spend to make sure that it's doing what I think it should be doing. And this is, again, going to be dependent on, do I want to do sampling of that vendor if they're conducting certain kinds of transactions for me? If they're, for example, preparing my loan documentation, maybe I want to spend a few hours each month conducting a sample, a review of a sample of transactions that they've done for me. If they're telemarketers, maybe I want to talk to, you know, that vendor on a monthly or quarterly basis and see are there recordings of the calls where I can, you know, listen in and see what's happening. So how much time you're going to spend is really dependent on what they're doing, how much they're doing, and again, you really want to go back to what are the risks associated with that. The higher the risk, the more time you're going to spend.
Great. Thanks, Arianne. So we are getting a number of questions with regards to the amount of content we're covering, and questions are arising as to whether or not the webinar is going to be archived, and wanted to reiterate that, yes, the archived version of this webinar should be available within the next week or so at the Consumer Compliance Outlook website. Again, that website is www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. So please reference the website for the archived version. So, Mark, I have a question with regards to auto dealers. Would auto dealers be considered vendors of the bank and each one be risk assessed, or have them approved by the indirect lending department and keep an approved list?
I would say that really it should be both. You're going to want to have the contact people, the indirect auto people that deal with the dealers directly, obviously keep track, ensure that the dealers are operating at a risk level and doing things properly, you know, within the risk appetite of the institution. But really this becomes third-party risk management in addition to vendor risk management and should be looked at in that manner. With auto dealers, sometimes we get into the issue of, you know, who is the creditor? Is, in fact, the bank also a creditor if the auto dealer is making the decision? And so that issue needs to be clearly vetted and understood. And obviously the applicable requirements under Reg B and Reg Z monitored and ensure that they're adhered to.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Similarly, we've received questions with regards to correspondent lenders. Arianne, I'll throw this one to you. Are correspondent lenders that aren't brokers who sell closed and self-funded residential mortgage loans in a secondary market transaction model considered vendors of the purchasing bank?
So I think this builds on what Mark was talking about, and I think the important thing to think about here is not to necessarily get caught up in the exact definition of a vendor. I don't know that I'd call correspondent lenders a vendor, but that doesn't mean you don't have risks there that you need to manage. So, you know, there are, if that vendor, I'm sorry, I just called it a vendor even though I said it's probably not a vendor. So if that lender didn't have good underwriting practices and, again, was making loans to people who weren't necessarily qualified, if they were engaged in practices that that could be considered unfair or deceptive. If they, those are the kinds of things you want to think about because there is some liability that may ultimately travel with that loan to the purchaser. You know, least of which is credit risk. If you've purchased that loan and, you know, depending on whether you bought it with or without recourse, you may have some credit risk there. So I think the thing to think about is, that correspondent may or may not specifically be a vendor, but I still want to do due diligence in terms of, you know, understanding how they operate, understanding how they ensure that they're complying with laws and regulations, and whether, you know, they understand things like UDAP and Reg Z and how they're making sure that, you know, the disclosures are being adequately prepared. So you may do slightly different types of due diligence, but I'd say you still want to do due diligence, you still want to include them in your risk assessment, and then what you do on an ongoing basis may be different, but there's still some work that you'd want to do there.
Thanks, Arianne. So we've got another question, Mark, on the compliance program. Can you expand on your comments regarding the Board of Directors oversight and what should be reported to them?
Absolutely. That's a great question because, you know, as everyone on the line is well aware, the board is ultimately responsible for setting the risk appetite for the institution. And without giving them proper and full information on different activities that the institution is engaging in, either directly or through the use of third parties and vendors, they won't be able to adequately assess the overall risk level that the institution is facing. Now, that being said, your vendor risk management policy should be the first thing that's provided to the board, and that's where they'll lay out their expectations for the amount of information and the detail of that information. Some, you know, obvious suggestions are that the initial due diligence and risk assessment be provided for major vendor-related activities. Let's say you're taking on a new product line or something like that that you've never taken on before. You're going to want to run that by the board and provide them the initial due diligence and risk assessment ahead of engaging in that activity. That being said, on an ongoing basis, it's a best practice for the board to receive regular reports on the results of the ongoing monitoring, if there are any concerns, and highlight those concerns for the board, and also to make the vendor risk management personnel available in case the board has further questions.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Follow-up question with regards to board oversight. Arianne, I'll throw this one to you. Can oversight be delegated to bank personnel committees from the board of directors?
So I won't comment on the specific committee without knowing more about kind of what that committee does and its function. I won't comment on that. But from a more broad perspective, I would say I'm not as much concerned that that process is delegated as I am that it's delegated to a person or a committee or a department that makes sense, that has the skill to do that. I think I've also heard similar questions of, you know, can individual departments assess do their due diligence as opposed to having it centralized? And I think that's all the same. I think some things you want to think about are, it makes sense to me that wherever it's done, whether it's done in committees, whether it's done in individual departments, or by specific people, that there's some mechanism to make sure that that information can be rolled up and considered across the organization and presented to the board and senior management in a way that they can get the full picture. It's not uncommon for us to be in a bank and have that function kind of so spread out that it's difficult to understand all the vendors and what they do and where the contracts are. So I think regardless of where that is, it needs to be done by someone or some committee or some group that can really roll that information up and that's qualified to do it. I think there's some value, too, in ensuring that that there's some consistency in how it's done. You don't want to have one vendor monitored, you know, overly monitored, one vendor not monitored at all. So I think regardless of where you put it, and I won't say, again, that any specific committee is or is not the right place, again, you want to make sure that it's done on the risk assessment, that there's consistency in how it's managed, and that they're able to present kind of the big picture. And then, again, when there's regulatory concerns involved, you want to make sure that your compliance department is involved so they can consider the regulatory questions. The one thing that would pop into my head is, you know, a personnel committee, are they going to understand all the different laws and regulations? That might be something that you want to think about. So get that there. And then kind of hearkening back to my earlier question, depending on the kinds of vendors and the functions they're performing for you, again, you want to make sure you have the right expertise or that whoever's assessing those has access to the right expertise. So something that's very IT-specific, you want to make sure that whoever's doing that due diligence has access to people that can answer the right questions and get them the right information.
Great. Thanks, Arianne. So we are at the top of the hour, so I'm going to begin the wrap-up process. I'd like to thank all of our presenters. We were definitely fortunate to get their perspective regarding vendor risk management, and we hope you found this presentation useful. As soon as the presentation ends and you exit the main menu, a short feedback form should appear on your screen. It may not appear if you have your pop-up blockers set. In any case, you can select the survey tab before exiting the main screen to access the feedback form. We would appreciate it if you could take just a couple of minutes to let us know what you liked about the presentation, any suggestions for improvement, and possible topics for future calls. I want to stress the importance of your feedback, not only on ways we can improve these events, but also on other ways in which we can continue a productive dialogue with the industry. Thanks for joining us. That does conclude our call. Please look for future announcements on future events. Thank you.